This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
My name is Mike Kalichman. I'm the director for the Center for Ethics and Science and Technology. And this evening, the Ethics Center is following in a tradition we've started for the last 3 years, where we focused on one book for the entire year, for most of the year in our programs. This year was Siddhartha Mukherjee's Emperor of All Maladies. In these programs, we are trying to use public forums as a way to both hear about exciting developments in science and technology, but to also talk about where the ethical challenges are that go with those developments. Our presumption is that we want these new developments, but we need to figure out what are the hurdles that we have to overcome in order to maximally gain from those developments. And those challenges are ones that should not just be in the domain of scientists, but part of the public as well. The public should be part of a dialogue that tries to determine what those issues are. In this series so far on cancer, we've heard remarkable success stories that hold promise for revolutionizing our relationship to cancer. In December, Rizal Kurzrock, a leading San Diego cancer researcher at the UCSD Moores Cancer Center, spoke about a personalized approach to cancer based on specific genetic variations in a patient's tumor. The video of her program has been viewed nearly 250,000 times on UCSD TV. In February, Patrick Soon-Shiong spoke of moving personalized cancer medicine to a whole new level based on the creation of a nationwide infrastructure allowing for rapid exchange of information about not only DNA, but RNA, the proteins that are produced, and the effectiveness of different drug treatments. Although his plans seem audacious, Soon-Shiong's remarkable successes with pancreatic cancer ensure that his vision should be taken seriously. His program warranted a front-page story in the Union Tribune. Last month, an audience of approximately 500 at the La Jolla Playhouse heard about another version of hope for cancer treatment based on Carl June's work in harnessing a patient's own immune system to fight their cancer. His approach in patients for whom all other treatments had failed resulted in remission, often indistinguishable from a cure. We live in a remarkable time. While not certain, it is possible that most cancers will soon become not just treatable, but perhaps curable diseases. The premise of our programs is that those successes are important enough that we should spend some time up front identifying where ethical challenges might slow progress if unchecked. We are interested in the choices that we make about what will be studied, the choices we make about how studies will be conducted, and the choices we will have to make in how our newfound knowledge is applied in the clinic. These are some of the questions that medical ethicists think about daily and which we will address this evening. Before introducing tonight's speaker, I want to also acknowledge the many organizations that have made this series possible. Primary supporters of the overall series have included San Diego State University, University of San Diego, UC San Diego, the Moores Cancer Center, Grossmont College, Point Loma Nazarene University, Sanford Burnham Medical Research Institute, Sharp Healthcare, the Reuben H. Fleet Science Center, and the Legler Benbow Foundation, as well as varying degrees of many other participating organizations and institutions. I'm delighted now to introduce tonight's speaker, Rebecca Dresser. I first met Dr. Dresser when she joined us for a program on human embryonic stem cell research 9 years ago. We had invited her because of her membership in the President's Council on Bioethics, which had been wrestling with the challenges of stem cell research. This was one of the first programs that helped to launch our Ethics Center, now celebrating its 10th anniversary, so it's very fitting that we have her back again. Today, Rebecca is the Daniel Noyes Kirby Professor of Law and Professor of Ethics and Medicine at Washington University in St. Louis. She received her law degree from Harvard Law School and has now worked in bioethics for many years. She also has close ties to the Hastings Center, the best-known bioethics center in the world. She is a frequent contributor to the Hastings Report, a fellow of the Hastings Center, and a board member. However, in 2006, Dresser also joined the ranks of those who had received a diagnosis of cancer. Armed with extensive experience in medical ethics and a network of colleagues in the healthcare field, she still found the experience extraordinarily difficult, often in ways she had not anticipated. She then did something uniquely academic. Having discovered other ethicist colleagues who also had faced cancer diagnoses, she initiated a project that culminated in a book titled Malignant: Medical Ethicists Confront Cancer, published by Oxford University Press in 2012. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Dresser.
So, someone like me who works in bioethics often looks at issues related to cancer, things like medical decision-making, the patient-physician relationship. Notice I said patient-physician, not physician-patient. I put the patient first. Clinical research and access to health care. So I'm going to talk today about this project that I worked on with six other people from bioethics. Five of us had had cancer. Two others had cared for a spouse who eventually died of cancer. And then we had one person who was in both categories. And so we all thought we were experts, right? But when we had our personal experience, we learned how much we didn't know about the experience of illness and having to deal with a disease like cancer. We learned a lot, and so we put together this book because we thought it might be helpful to others to know what we learned, our colleagues who teach this stuff, doctors who treat patients, and then people like you who probably have had to deal with cancer in one way or another in your own lives. Practically everybody does in this country. So to put the book together, we met a couple times and we talked a lot. It was interesting because it was kind of a cross between a support group and an academic conference. There were even some tears. So it was different from the usual project we had been involved in. We then taped and made a transcript of our meetings, so this became kind of the raw material for the book. We looked at cancer kind of on a timeline, so issues that came up in the so-called diagnostic odyssey, that is before we were diagnosed. Some of us had symptoms and nobody could figure out what they were, and then finally somebody decided it was cancer. A couple people were diagnosed just through mammography or prostate PSA screening. So anyway, issues that came up at that point, how we learned about our diagnosis, the bad news. And then treatment, what life was like during that time. Most of us had to step away from ordinary life, deal with, you know, the burdens of chemo and surgery, radiation, so forth, deal with the fragmentation of healthcare and many things that everybody deals with. And then after treatment ends, for the fortunate people like me so far, life in what one of our members, Art Frank, calls the remission society. We kind of prefer that term to survivor. I don't know, for a lot of reasons, but one reason is it kind of indicates the tentative position that you're in. You don't know for sure. And so some of that involves, you know, going back for the scans that you have to have every period, you know, certain period of time, and all the anxiety and so forth, and what it's like to go back to work, resume our ordinary activities, issues that that raised, returning to teaching and trying to share with our students what we had learned. Most of us teach med students. And then for two of our group members whose spouses came to the end of their treatment, they had to think about, should we try a long shot? Shouldn't we? And then finally dealing with the dying process. So let me tell you just about the chapters in the book. And I'm going to tell you two stories that have to do with truth-telling in medicine. But we covered a lot of other topics. So if you're interested in writing a comment or a question, just to maybe provoke you, your thinking, Besides the diagnostic, the way we came to diagnosis, in fact, one person was diagnosed when he had a kidney stone. This is a physician, and a resident ordered a CT scan, and this doctor patient said, "There's no reason to get a CT scan. It's a waste of money. It's not going to change your treatment of my kidney stone," because he had had many of these, and he knew the drill. But the resident said, "No, I think we should." So anyway, they had this unnecessary CT scan, which then turned out to show that he had kidney cancer. And they happened to catch it very early, or reasonably early, and he was treated successfully because of that. So it was an accidental diagnosis. Coping with uncertainty. When you're trying to make a treatment decision and they're giving you information about the odds of different options, it turns out that in many cases it's a lot less certain than you might have thought. I don't know if any of you have dealt with that, but many of us dealt with that. And you would go on the internet and find one set of statistics. You would hear different statistics from different doctors. Very confusing. So how do you make an informed choice? Autonomy and persuasion, that's a chapter I wrote about. At one point, I needed a feeding tube. I had oral cancer, and it's affected my speech, so I apologize for that. I don't have much saliva. Anyway, at some point, I got down to about 100 pounds, and I really needed a feeding tube. I did not want that feeding tube. I was very stubborn, and I needed to be pretty much bullied into it, and I was very glad that I was, after the fact. So I should have been, I was a very informed decision, rational decision maker, rational person, I hope, but I wasn't making a very good decision. And the message from that is that doctors need to perhaps argue with patients sometimes when they're making decisions that are questionable, or at least try to persuade them to think about the options more seriously. Another chapter on being in research. A chapter about resilience. This is by the person who had breast cancer. She was about a few months after her own treatment, so she was just getting back to things. Her husband was diagnosed with a very rare cancer and died in, I think it was 6 or 8 weeks. So she had to deal with both of those. And so she wrote about the art of living in remission, how she tried to deal with that. Questionable benefit treatment. This is some of the treatments for cancer. Very, very expensive. So far, maybe have helped 2% of people live longer. Is that something that society should pay for? Is that something patients should be interested in? What are the downsides of that? One thing that we learned is that when you come up against a choice between doing something to try to prolong your life or not, you may, some of your values or your ideas about what you would do change, and you're more receptive to doing iffy things than you might have thought you would have been before. Cancer stereotypes. When you tell somebody you have cancer, if you've ever done that, that really freaks them out. It has good and bad sides. They're very compassionate. They feel very sorry for you. They want to help you. But they also, some people are frightened of you. They're very uncomfortable. They want to get away from you because you remind them of their mortality. We had a lot of adventures with that. Caregiver, the ethics of being a caregiver from the patient's point of view and the caregiver's. When should the caregiver try to talk with the patient about a decision the patient's made that the caregiver may disagree with? When does the caregiver have a right to say, "I need a break"? Lots of things come up in that area. Cancer interactions, that's a chapter about people outside of the healthcare setting and how they treated us, and how some people, I think, inadvertently said harmful things. Some people would say, oh, well, that's just a really good opportunity, your cancer journey. You'll learn a lot from it. I'm sorry. I don't think it's so great myself. So if any of you have run into that sort of thing, I'd love to hear about it. And then being a survivor. If you're lucky enough to be a survivor, a member of the Remission Society, I think most people, or many people, feel they want to give back, they want to help people, they want to share what they've learned. That's why there are so many books about cancer. So many people want to talk about it. But just, you know, what's a good way to live as a person who has been able to survive at least for a while after cancer? So those are the general topics. So I am going to talk about, as I said, truth-telling, and maybe this will also provoke some thoughts in you. So one of the stories is from another member of the group, John Robertson, and this his wife had ovarian cancer. So in 2005, John and his wife, Carlotta, who were both professors at the University of Texas, had planned a trip to London. And they were going there for a conference and to celebrate Carlotta's birthday. The day before they were to leave, Carlotta told John that she hadn't been feeling well. Her stomach was swollen, and she had gone to see a family practitioner she had consulted before about minor problems. The doctor had ordered an ultrasound and gotten the results, but didn't tell Carlotta about them. He just told her it would be okay to go ahead and go on the trip, and when she came back, she could have some more tests. This was a shock to John. Carlotta was a stoic, and she didn't like to be ill. She didn't like doctors, but she had mentioned a few times she wasn't feeling well. But he was still just surprised that this had happened. He didn't know what to do. He's a medical ethics person. He felt sort of, well, I should know how to handle this, but he didn't really know whether they should go or not. Carlotta was insisting that they go, so they went. He sees now that neither one of them wanted to admit that it might be something serious. They didn't want to interrupt their plans. So they went ahead to London, had a couple days of sightseeing, but Carlotta was really not feeling well, and she was very weak, and by the third day, it became obvious that they needed to go home early. They went home. Carlotta had a CT scan, and they met with this family practitioner to talk about the results. He advised them to see a specialist and arranged an appointment with Carlotta's gynecologist the next day. Didn't say anything to them about the scans. But later, John discovered that this doctor actually had the full scan report, and he knew that Carlotta had advanced cancer. He didn't say anything. He apparently couldn't bear to tell them the bad news. So the next day, they went to her gynecologist, who directly and forcefully announced that Carlotta's abdomen was full of cancer. The doctor offered no words of support, just made an appointment with a cancer specialist, and got them out of her office. Like the family practitioner, she didn't want to deal with the situation. A few days later, they went to see the oncologist, who said the cancer appeared to be quite advanced and recommended chemotherapy and then surgery. This doctor was straightforward, like the gynecologist, but also more humane. She helped them think through what to do and tried to make Carlotta more comfortable. Eventually, Carlotta was diagnosed as having late-stage ovarian cancer. So once her treatment was underway, they received some more clear signals that the situation was grave. One came from this gynecological oncologist who is now in charge of Carlotta's treatment. When Carlotta went for her first round of chemotherapy, the oncologist came in and sat with Carlotta and John for a few minutes. And this is very unusual. I know when I was going through chemo, I never saw my doctor. I saw him in his office. So this was unusual. And the doctor remarked that although many people think a sudden death is a good death, she thought that having time to say goodbye and settle accounts was in many ways better. So John took this as a sort of indirect message that this is serious, this is probably terminal. But it was indirect, and it was, I don't know what you think of that, but it was a way of telling them the truth, but not in a brutal way. Another signal they got that night, Carlotta got a high fever in reaction to the chemo. The oncologist told them to go to the emergency room immediately. And there, in the course of examining Carlotta, the emergency room physician said to her, "You have terminal cancer." This person had never met her, didn't know where she was. So this was a shock to Carlotta and John. They hadn't attached the T word to her illness yet. And the brutality of this statement instilled in them a loathing of the emergency room, and they never went there again. So here's a few things to consider about the story. There were some members of a group who, like John, dealt with doctors who displayed surprising insensitivity. The gynecologist who told them that Carlotta had cancer never said a word about how sorry she was to have to give them such devastating news. And this was someone Carlotta had seen, you know, yearly for her pap smears and so forth. The emergency doctor was even worse with his terse statement that her condition was terminal. And then there was the evasive behavior of the family practice doctor. Some of us had doctors who failed to give us adequate information when we were diagnosed. They told us we had cancer, but failed to say what could be done about it. When this happens, patients whose cancer can be treated suffer days of needless terror before learning about their options. So, you know, you're just hanging out there. You don't know how serious it is. And even with an advanced disease like Carlotta's, doctors can reassure patients that they will do everything they can to provide care and comfort in whatever time remains. When doctors have reason to suspect cancer, but they're not sure, they need more information, they can still reassure patients. Art Frank, who was in our group, had a doctor who did exactly that. When Art asked the doctor whether he might have cancer, this was actually a sports medicine doctor who was very sensitive. That doctor said, "Yes, it could be cancer, but if it is, we'll be right there with you." And Art had cancer over 20 years ago, and he still remembers how comforting that statement was. So there are lots of issues with breaking bad news. How do doctors handle that? A special challenge arises with the H word, the hope word. With a life-threatening illness like Carlotta's, patients and families often hope for a miracle. But they can also have more achievable hopes, that the patient can be comfortable, that the patient can have some period of treatment where they're still able to function. Carlotta actually lived for 3 years and taught until about 2 days before she died. So even though most doctors can't work miracles, they can make these smaller hopes a reality. Looking back, John can see that Carlotta's oncologist tried to focus their attention on these smaller hopes by coming in and talking to them about, you know, if you have time to say goodbye to people, that's a good thing. That conversation was meant to show them what they could reasonably hope for. They actually got a lot more than that. John is still angry at the family practitioner for saying they could go to London and for not being honest with them when they returned. He's also able to see, though, that the family practitioner was probably out of his depth. You know, he was not used to diagnosing cancer, and maybe it would be better to have an expert do it, but the way that was not a good way to handle it. And he never checked in with them again to see how she was doing. He never followed up. So truth-telling is complicated. You know, even the emergency room doctor told the truth, you have terminal cancer, but that was not a good ethical way to do it. The complexity of truth-telling leads to my next story. And this is one that's not in the book, but I wrote in a different article. I call this one A Terrifying Truth. My father died of cancer when I was 12 and he was 39. No one told me or my brothers, my younger brothers, that he was dying. He went to the hospital in October and died in December. And we only saw him twice during this time. This was the 1960s, and at that time, children under 12 were not allowed in the hospital. And, you know, the view there was, then was you should protect the children, not talk about it. My mother, nobody told me, any of us, what was wrong with our dad, even though we certainly sensed it was something bad. My mother was never home. We spent many hours in the care of relatives. Every so often, one of us would work up the courage to ask when our dad was coming home, and we would get these vague replies that were supposed to reassure us, but did not. I'll never forget this unsettling time. The adults around me acted as though everything was fine, but why was my mother crying in the middle of the night? And why were we eating casseroles, which we didn't like, prepared by our neighbors for dinner? The night that we learned our father had died was awful, of course, but it was also a small part of me was also relieved to know the truth. I remember thinking, oh, so that's why everyone has been acting so strangely. So this is the way I learned that people should tell the truth about serious illness. And this is the way I learned that shielding children from bad news does them no good. And my father's cancer was really my introduction to medical ethics and really began a lifelong interest in the subject. I wasn't aware of this, but I think I gravitated to the topic because of this experience. So once I became somebody who worked in the field of medical ethics, cancer became primarily a professional rather than a personal matter. And then, 42 years after my father died, it became personal again, and I got my own diagnosis. As a 12-year-old, I learned how frightening it can be when people don't tell you the truth. And as a patient, I learned how frightening it is when they do tell you the truth. Knowing about a life-threatening diagnosis may be better than not knowing, but it's terrible knowledge. With it come impossible treatment choices. For me, the choice between surgery, possibly more effective, but more likely to leave me unable to speak and swallow. And then the other choice, chemotherapy and radiation. I had no idea how to make this choice. You know, supposedly you come to the choice with your values and you make a decision. I didn't know how to decide. And fortunately, the tumor board, which is when all the different doctors meet together and talk about a case and they make a recommendation, did that for me, and I was so grateful to have that recommendation. So most of us in this project learned that we were much more dependent on doctors than we would have thought we would have been. Once I made the decision to have chemotherapy and radiation, I didn't really want to think about the truth. The truth was that treatment might be ineffective. But I didn't really want anybody reminding me of that when I was going through the pain, the nausea, the vomiting, all the other side effects. So I guess the bottom line for me was that truth-telling in medicine is necessary, but coping with the truth is much more difficult than I imagined before I was dealing with cancer myself. I can see now why my mother didn't want to tell her young children that their father was dying. She was not equipped to do that, prepared to do that. She didn't succeed in protecting us, but I can see the burden she was dealing with. Also, I didn't realize how much patients and families need help from clinicians to handle the truth. My mother really needed somebody, maybe a medical social worker, who could sit down with her and talk with her about how to talk to the children about this. I don't think they had those back in the 60s. Fortunately, they do now. But she needed some help. I mean, one thing we learned, all of us talked about, doctors have this whole issue of breaking bad news to patients. Patients have the issue of breaking bad news to all their family, their friends, their coworkers. And we don't get any training in that. And that was very difficult. So people need help handling the truth. I needed clinicians who could help me choose a treatment and then let me kind of put the truth aside for a while so I could concentrate on getting through the treatment. So I do think that truth-telling is the least worst option when you have cancer. But truth-telling is also destructive. It inflicts a new and terrifying reality on patients and the people who love them. So I think besides telling the truth, doctors and nurses should try to reduce the destructive effects of their message. And sometimes this means talking with patients about how they will convey the truth to their families and friends, recommending a treatment, a patient... to a patient who's overwhelmed by the truth. Sometimes this means downplaying the truth that a burdensome treatment could fail. Not the whole time, but off and on. So personal experience taught everybody in our project that truth-telling in medicine was much more complicated and potentially harmful than we realized before we dealt with cancer ourselves. So I'm going to stop now, and I'm very excited to hear from you and talk with you about your thoughts.
When we talk about ethics, we're talking about not necessarily having to do a detailed theoretical analysis of what we do, but instead simply asking basic questions about how should we act, what should we do, who are the stakeholders that are involved in making those decisions, to what extent do they, and by they I mean we, have choices that might be made to make things better? Now, having said that, one of the things that I want to start with is sort of a meta question, a question that overrides a lot of these others based on what we've heard. Ethicists who write about issues in the world around us often are writing about things they haven't experienced, as you and your colleagues discovered. And I was thinking about a case that we talked about often in research ethics classes. Some of you may have heard of something called the Perenkopf Atlas. This was a human anatomy and atlas that was prepared during World War II in Nazi Germany by someone who almost undoubtedly was a Nazi, but that is not the main concern, almost undoubtedly obtained his wonderfully excellent specimens for the dissections and drawings that he did by taking people out of concentration camps and having them killed in order that they could have fresh material to study. A terrible thing, but apparently by many accounts some of the best possible drawings that one could look at. And my understanding is that a lot of ethicists looked at that from a theoretical point of view, and the way they approached it was to say, well, theoretically this is a really bad thing, we should not give credibility to it, we should not use it. And then there was an interesting study that was done where people who were concentration camp victims who had suffered through and survived what happened in Nazi Germany, and they were asked what they thought, and about half of them said they should be used so at least something good comes out of this. So this is a little bit of a long-winded way to say, is it fair for us to generalize from what we've just heard that maybe we can't tr- trust ethicists to analyze these questions for us, and only people who have experienced something should talk about it. What did you learn
from
this?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. And if we were to go that far with ethicists, we should definitely go that far with doctors and nurses, right? I mean, I got the idea for my project when I was lying in bed feeling kind of sick after chemo, and I heard two doctors come on the radio talking about they had been doctors treating cancer patients, and then they got cancer. And they talked about how much they learned from that experience. So I don't know if you want to... I mean, when I talk about this with my law professor colleagues, I say, so it's like if you teach family law, things like divorce, adoption, you should really go through that yourself so you can be a better teacher. I think that would be right. Too limiting. But I do think that people who haven't had the personal experience should try to learn from the people who have and try to get tuned into the personal side, because I do think there were many things we saw. For example, if you're a cancer patient and you have an issue over the weekend, your only option usually is go to the emergency room. Usually, you're feeling so terrible and frail, and the idea of going and then sitting for hours waiting your turn, it's just awful. It was very interesting to me that this happened to me. And I talked to a resident about, well, should I come in or not? She said, well, what do you think you should do? I said, I have no idea. I don't know anything about this. But anyway, a couple years after I was treated, our cancer center opened a special emergency room for cancer patients. And I just thought, that is such a great idea. So there are little things that wouldn't be that difficult to change if people were just more aware of how important they are. So that's one thing. And then the deeper things, like I don't think most doctors who break the bad news ever think about, well, this patient is going to have to tell somebody else about that. They don't even think about it. It's not in their consciousness. So I think they would learn a lot more that would be make them more sensitive to patients. And I think ethicists would learn a lot more, too.
No, that's exactly what I was looking for. I mean, it doesn't seem reasonable to say that nothing would be done, but it does seem reasonable to say that there perhaps needs to be more of a collaboration between ethicists and social scientists who might help to understand what some of these experiences are.
Or the patients themselves. I don't know if any of you had this opportunity. When I was diagnosed, I so much wanted to talk to some patients who had been through the different things I was offered. And that I didn't have that opportunity. But I think that's really a wonderful thing for patients.
There is a... let me just make sure I know which chapter it was. Arthur Frank's chapter on support groups. And so you could talk to other people with cancer in support groups, and without, you know, sort of delving into what I think were some of his main messages, did you participate in any support groups? And if not, why not?
I didn't. One reason was, well, I made my own support group with the book. A couple of us talked about this. We were so fatigued from the treatment, and we had so many appointments already that we just didn't want another appointment to go to a support group. I'm a big fan of support groups, and I think they help a lot of people. It just wasn't something I did. I might have done if I kind of had an informal support group. I found there were a student in my school, another professor at Washington University, and a relative of another professor who all had the same kind of cancer I had. So we got together and talked, and that was very helpful.
Yeah, so part of the reason I mentioned Arthur Frank's observation was because it appears that, I think if the way I read it, he was making a good case that a support group can be wonderful, but you don't know what you're getting. So you, depending on the particular group and the particular approach, it might be something that would be far more of a burden than a help. And when you add to that the context of already having too much to do, for many, it would be arguably an activation barrier to wanting to even consider.
I think that's why online support groups have gotten pretty popular among a lot of patients.
So I'm going to jump into the cards, since we do have lots of questions, and we don't need to worry about going to my questions. So we're first going to talk about a couple of things about what should we be studying. So this first question in that category is, in your experience as a cancer patient, do you feel like the physicians who treated you and your colleagues understood and or prioritized your values in the treatment process? What values were included, religious, spiritual, purely medicine, or research-based? So did they think about your values?
Well, I think we were privileged patients. Many of us were getting treatment in the same places we worked. And we had a couple doctors as well. And so we really all felt they were trying to respect our autonomy and our, you know, self-determination, our personal choices, perhaps too much. I know for me, when I had an incident where I needed this feeding tube, and I don't know, but I think perhaps my doctor was a little bit more deferential to me because I was somebody who worked there, and he might have been more willing to kind of question me when I was putting it off if I hadn't been a professor there. But what we found, another doctor mentioned that we all said we were called, regarded as honorary doctors. They sort of assumed that we would know stuff and we were different from the ordinary patient. But we didn't know anything, and even the doctors, one was a pediatrician, and he didn't know anything about his kind of cancer, but he said his doctors expected him to set up his own scan. He said, I didn't know how to do that. So none of us felt we were pressured or bullied or anything like that. We were given respect, but perhaps not as much guidance as we wanted or needed. I don't know how unusual that was. I think one negative side effect of medical ethics has been that we have emphasized this patient autonomy with the students, you know, hammer them ahead with the patient's choice, that they come away with this idea that they just spit out the information and they say to the patient, okay, what do you want to do? The patient says, this. Okay, see you later. You know, there's really not a conversation or a discussion of, well, what's most important to you, you know, in your life? What is it that you most want to hold on to? You know, how do you feel about... Today we were talking about prostate cancer, and that's a very hard situation where you, when you choose among different options... surgery has these side of many men are left impotent and incontinent. One person in the group who was in that situation, in retrospect, wished that his doctor had said, okay, this could happen to you. You know, how do you think you would handle that? What would that be like for you? There are some ways to treat it if it does happen. Just sort of more talking about how do you think you're going to react to these different things. We had very little of that. So I don't know. I think they sort of saw us as people coming with values, and we would just exercise our values, and they wouldn't try to delve into our values very much. More of a hands-off approach.
Yeah, so this next question kind of emerges with the last one in terms of what a doctor should be able to do in evaluating what a patient needs to hear or wants to hear. The question is, how should a doctor evaluate patient's mental state, depressive, hyperanxious, catastrophic, what their home life is like, when telling the patient the truth? And truth is put in quotes here. And I would sort of extend that to say that, I mean, we've had some discussions separately, too, about the the difficulty of knowing what's best for a particular patient and how much, you know, I mean, I don't think they're asking you to explain what a doctor should look for to know what a patient's mental state is. It's not your expertise. But I think what we are asking here, we should be asking, is how much can we reasonably expect of a doctor to be able to figure out who we are, what we need?
Right. That does tie in. And I must say, we developed more of an appreciation for the difficulty of what the doctor has to do. Usually in oncology, they're meeting the patient for the first time. They don't know if the patient is somebody who wants to know everything, doesn't want to know very much, you know, what kind of a person they are. And they have to feel their way. My oncologist read the chapters I wrote about the feeding tube, and he was the one who I sort of said, I wish you would have persuaded me more. And he's a wonderful man. And he told me that he's very aware of how different personality styles patients have, and he tries to fill it out. And one of my oncologists told me, you were one of the most stubborn patients I've ever had. but they're not, you know, they're not omniscient. They can't know for sure. I think once you, through the relationship, you know, they can ask, they can say, okay, I'm going to give you the basic information, and then you can tell me, do you want to know more? I think that doctors can't just put everything on the patient to say, well, I want to know about X, Y, because patients don't know what to ask. So I think they need to say things like, well, I could give you more information about this sort of a side effect, or do you want to hear more information about the process of having this kind of a chemotherapy? But sort of signal to them the information that they might want to know about, because they don't know. And then, you know, patient can say yes or no. I've had too much information now. I'm ready to take a break, and you know, I'll ask you the next time or something. But feel out patients. But there is no way they can look at you and know exactly how to tell you the information and what you need. And you don't even know. And one thing we talked about was we went back and forth. Some days we wanted to know everything, and other days we wanted to know nothing. It's really, you change from time to time. We found that.
That's good. No, I think part of what you're saying is that it isn't easy. There isn't a black and white formula for what should be done, but there still is a conversation here about, in terms of thinking about how to make things better, how do we do that? And one of these questions is, and I don't know the answer to this, I'm hoping you do, are medical schools doing anything about communication between doctors and patients to try and help them to better understand how to figure out what a patient actually needs and what they don't need?
Yes. They are doing more than they used to. There are these things called simulated patients. Have you ever heard of that? So these are actors who make money. They have a tough life. They are hired by med schools, and they play patients. So they're given a role, and they're, you know, you have this disease, and here's all the information, here's your situation, and they learn the role, and then they come in, and the med students talk to them, and usually it's taped, and then they go over the conversation afterwards, and then the patient tells them, you know, what they did right and wrong, gives them feedback, as well as the professors, and so they do this now. You know, how much of it takes, and this is one part of their massive medical education. Some of them are very tuned into this and really gravitate to it. Others see it as, well, as something I have to get over with. I try to encourage them, when they are in the third and fourth year, when they start going into the units in the real world look for role models. I think that's where they learn the most. People who do it well and watch them and try to do what they do. So they are more tuned into it. That doesn't mean all the young doctors you run into are going to be wonderful. On the downside is they tend to be young people who are invincible and can't even imagine being seriously ill. Some of them have dealt with it, but you know they don't have the personal experience, and they don't have the experience of seeing a lot of patients. So, good news, bad news.
Good, thanks. So this next question is a little bit afield. It's in this group of questions with some others, but I think it might be interesting to hear your take on it. We are on the verge of, as I mentioned before, some potentially great breakthroughs in personalized medicine for cancer treatment. And this person is asking, what do you think is the future of personal or DNA-guided treatments in light of the insurance company push for standard treatments, where right now an insurance company has an expectation that they will pay for a treatment that's improved for a particular cancer, but not necessarily a treatment that DNA or genotyping tells you that this particular cancer might be responsive to a different chemotherapeutic agent than one that's already been proven for that particular kind of cancer. So it raises, I think, some ethical issues as well as how we go from here to where that's going.
Yeah, there is a little bit of that sort of treatment now going on with Herceptin is, appropriate for only a certain kind of breast cancer, and the insurance companies are paying for that. It's getting the evidence to show them that, this is really a smart thing to do for them, because if they're targeting the treatment to the patient, the treatment that's most likely to work, that's going to be cost-effective for them. But it will take a lot of research and evidence and stuff for them to adjust. I think it'll be a case-by-case, disease-by-disease step. I think it's very exciting, the things they're doing, and I'm on a committee where we've looked at Dr. Tune's work, and, there's excitement in the air. I just hope that in all the excitement, we don't forget about all the patients who aren't going to be the beneficiaries of this. People who have to deal with cancer now, people who do not have a successful treatment. And we want to put our care and concern and resources into them too. So I don't want the system to get too balanced, in favor of push for cure for everybody. Okay, do that, but remember, there are no diseases we cure 100%, and you got to help the people who have to deal with the sadness and the grieving and the effects of our mortality, which we're all going to die of something sometime. So we can't forget about the mortality part.
I think it's a very good point, because even if we get the best we can hope for from all of the promising research in cancer, that's still not going to mean that everybody is going to be treated without side effects and cured immediately. So it could be very easy to start saying, oh, well, it's no big deal, but it still remains for that individual a big deal for whatever happens to them.
Right, and if you've been around as long as I have, you've seen this excitement before. Interferon, periodically there is excitement. And usually what ends up happening is it helps some people some. it's never the miracle that it's often portrayed as at the beginning, because human bodies are very complicated. This stuff is very difficult. And it's hard to have success.
On these notes, and a lot of these have to do with the physician interaction with the patient, I want to press you a little bit on John Robertson's chapter about his wife's ovarian cancer, and they weren't told about the news that she probably had extremely advanced cancer before the trip. It sounded like the interpretation of John and maybe you was that the physician was afraid to talk about the cancer, which may very well be the case. But is there also room for a possibility that the physician thought, if they can go on this one last trip and at least spend some time thinking that everything is fine and not facing that mortality, that the physician was making a decision for them?
I'm sure that's a possibility. But was that right?
Well, that's...
Was it right for him to make that decision for them?
Yeah, so we're just about wrapping up, and I just want to comment on this research question because of personal experience. So some of you have attended an earlier program. I once previously mentioned that a couple of weeks after making the decision that we would use The Emperor of All Maladies as our book for this year, I was diagnosed with cancer. And so I spent most of this last year going through chemo and radiation surgery, 6 months of chemo. And during that process, early on, when it was fairly easy with just the initial chemo and radiation, I was asked if I would like to participate in a very simple clinical trial. And the first thing that went off my head was, people have to do these studies, this obligation to the people that, the people that have preceded me and been willing to go through and take the risks, making it possible for me to do this. Second thing I realized was that already, not only was I overwhelmed, but my primary caregiver was overwhelmed. And the idea of adding even just one more thing to something that was already so difficult seemed impossible. Mm-hmm. And looking at that, I mean, you just described something I had not thought about, that even as these long-term trials go on, other things may come up that no longer mean those trials are ethical, even, because when you do a clinical trial, you can't randomize somebody to a care to an approach that you know is better than what the standard of care should be. It was worse than the standard of care should be. And as a result of that, you should get something that's good enough, but you're getting something that's new, and, the trial you got may not have been as good as what you had. You just don't know. That's why we do the trials. So we need to wrap up. It is just past 7 o'clock. I want to thank everybody for their comments and their questions, and especially Rebecca for a really interesting topic for tonight.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.